Now, last time, I talked about the very important fact whether Marx had an essence of human nature, whether Marx's dialectic, his theory of history, was built on a concept of human nature, something that modern, certainly Stalinism and Bolshevism, would deny. And I said that certainly Marx had some presuppositions. And the presuppositions that he had came from the Enlightenment, in which he was brought up, which he never left, really, mentally. And that these were that the basis of human nature was freedom, happiness, and rationality. These three ideas, freedom, happiness, and rationality, which you also found in Lessing's Nathan the Wise, in your Enlightenment reading. And that, as far as Marx was concerned, freedom, happiness, and rationality were a part, we might say, of human consciousness. And that what he wrote in his life, in 1842, remained the goal, that freedom is so much the essence of man, Marx wrote, that its very enemies realize it in struggling against its reality. No man fights against freedom. At most, he fights against the freedom of others. And as I said last time, this is of vital importance, because it explains to you something that is otherwise quite unexplainable in Marx. Why people would storm the Bastille rather than wait for history to fulfill itself, if it is of the essence of Marxism that the change won't come about until capitalism has developed to its fullest extent. And only then will the new replace the old. Then why not wait till it has developed its fullest extent? Which the social democrats, of course, the essence of social democracy later, why not wait? Why fight? And the reason I have just said, why fight? And some of these ideas remained even in 1870, when he wrote in his famous pamphlet on the Paris Commune, called The 18th of Brumaire of Napoleon Bonaparte, when he wrote about the workers' heroic resolve, that the workers' heroic resolve is necessary to bring about the change in the class struggle. So that remained even there, if you like, with the idea of the heroic resolve. But once we have said that, we have to add immediately that for Marx, human nature is a social entity. That is to say, there is an essence of human nature, but it expresses itself in reality, not in an abstraction, as with the young Hegelians or in Feuerbach, but it expresses itself in acting, if you like, upon a reality. The individual, Hegel says, is a social entity, if you like. The individual is a social entity. Now, much of the misunderstanding of Marx has, I think, stemmed from the fact that he remained a Hegelian, and that Hegel is very difficult to grasp, as you well know, especially that close interlocking between consciousness and reality. But Marx has that. So there is a human essence, but there is also reality. And you can't really divide the two. The abolition of private property, as Marx says, will mark man's return from to his human, that is, Marx says, his social existence. So for Marx, the human and the social were one entity, because your basic nature, which tends towards freedom, happiness, And rationality expresses itself in social action. It finds its fulfillment in social action, as it does indeed in Hegel. After all, human nature, therefore, is, if you like, a social category. That is important, and that is something I think that you should not lose sight of. Now, all this makes only sense, that your tendency towards freedom, happiness, and rationality realizes itself in the concrete social sphere if the binding, what binds together your human essence and your consciousness and social rationality and social scene in which it realizes itself, what holds it together is man's inherent rationality. For Marx believed two things. First of all, that the dialectic, the unfolding of history, was rational. History unfolds rationally. That is Hegel. The feudalism gave way to the bourgeoisie. The bourgeoisie will give way to the proletariat. And the way that happens is through a dialectic relationship. This is Hegel. This is rationality. This is rational. And as history is rational, and you are rational, if you have the right consciousness, there is no conflict between you and the working of history. You are both rational. There is no conflict. And therefore, with your right consciousness, you not only grasp the dialectic, you not only grasp the working of history, you also draw the proper conclusion. The proper conclusion is, of course, that you should fight for change, that you should join the proletariat. This proper conclusion for Marx was part of a rationality, part of rationality. It is the same kind of thing, obviously. As he puts it, and I quote again, the realization of freedom requires the free rationality of those who achieve it. That is to say, you have to have rationality to achieve it. Now, the contradiction here is, how can you have that true consciousness in a world dominated by the bourgeoisie? How can you have this free consciousness in a world of domination? Or put it much better, in a world where you have alienation of labor. If your labor is alienated, as it is today, how can you have true consciousness? If your labor is alienated, how can you have rationality? How can you realize this potential in you when it can only be realized once the alienation of labor is abolished? And Marx's answer is clear, that there are some who can rise beyond it. This is the vanguard of the working classes. And that the vanguard of the working classes has that rationality. In other words, Marx's answer is, if you like, really irrational. Marx's answer is, if you like, a kind of leap, something that is necessary for his theory, but that is difficult to bring into to jibe with his theory. Yes, Marx would say, it's quite true. All of you are alienated. None of you can recognize the beauty of a diamond. All of you are fetishists, fetishism of goods, which undoubtedly you realized in your Thanksgiving dinner if you made, as I told you last time, a record of your family conversations. Yes? All of you are fetishists of goods, yes? All of you have these ideas that what you talk about is money. Money dominates everything, yes? Didn't you talk in Cedar Rapids how much the turkey cost? Yes, that was, of course, the big thing. So what you have, therefore, is yes, but Marx says quite irrationally, there are some who can rise above that. Some who can, himself included, of course, who can fulfill their rationality right here and now, and who therefore know the direction history is going, and who can take rational acts when the rest of humanity, including the proletariat for all its liberating function, is so alienated that you have to lead it out of alienation. That is the Communist Party. That is the vanguard of the proletariat. Don't forget that. So we can say that here we have a kind of jump. But we have another jump in Marx, if you want to put it again. And that is not the rationality. I think that's clear to most of you. Why? History is rational. Rational man must understand rational history. That's Hegel. But there's another jump, happiness. Now, why happiness? Well, the only answer I can give is because it was a deep 18th century belief. The deep 18th century belief in Nathan the Wise, in your reading and everything, is Glückseligkeit. Man must be happy. And the happiness comes through the use of his reason, his rationality. Yes? His tolerance, his goodness, his rationality. So you can say Marx's goal of happiness is again a presupposition, which in a way is irrational in the last resort. It's not Hegel at all, as you well know. It is really an 18th century presupposition. There isn't a hell of a lot you can say about it. But Marx believed that man must be happy. And good bourgeois belief, in a sense, that man must find happiness, that we must be happy, that there must be happiness, and an 18th century belief, and of course in belief that goes with the rejection of Christianity and Gnosticism, not for Hegel, but for Marx. Now, I come back for a minute to his rationality, because there's one thing I should still say about that. And that is, how do you know that history works that way as a rational being? Through scholarly proof. And of course, Marx spent a lifetime accumulating scholarly proof that history works the way he said it did. That is to say, in the Hegelian manner, the bourgeois replaces feudalism, the proletariat will replace the bourgeoisie, the dialectic which links these, the change, which is the strategy of change. And Marx believed once you, as a rational person, are convinced in your rationality that history works that way, then of course you will join the proletariat. And you will do all of this. And Marx spent a lifetime convincing you through the accumulation of proof, of scholarly, historical proof, so that in a sense Marxism falls or stands, with the historical proof that he accumulated in order to convince you as a rational person that history works that way, that we are now at a new change, and that the new change is the triumph of the proletariat. And he used that proof, of course, from history and economics. He took the proof where he should have taken it from history and from economic theory. And his ideas, therefore, stand and fall with whether his history is correct and whether his economic theory is correct. Now, I dare say nobody today would hold that his history is correct or his economic theory is correct. In other words, no historian, apart from some Bolsheviks, not even they, would hold anymore that his history is correct. Or that his economic theory is correct, I think no economist would hold anymore very much. But of course, many of the difficulty in the communist world comes still of clinging to 19th century economic theory, as you know, to solve 20th century economic problems. Yes? And of course, they cling to 19th century historical schema, which is not correct either. So anyway, setting that, what I hope I've made clear up to now is that what you have then in Marx is an 18th century man a presupposition about human nature. And that presupposition about human nature, meshing with the dialectic and history, and explaining to you really not only why people would fight, but also why Marx paid no attention to the classless society. Because once you've abolished the alienation of labor, once you have taken back what is yours, once you have abolished labor is no longer alienated labor, then the future will take care of itself. Your own human essence will come to triumph. Your own rationality, happiness, yes, will triumph. Idea of freedom. And the whole world will live together in freedom, rationality, and happiness. So at the end stands an 18th century utopia, which is no different, really, from the utopia of bourgeois society. It isn't that much different from the utopia of bourgeois society, which is also a utopia of freedom, happiness, and rationality, yes? After all, so it isn't really so much different. Marx was a man of his time, and if you were Marxist about it, a man of his class, which was certainly not the working class. He was a cultured German. And it is the idea also that in the last resort, it is culture, reading Shakespeare, above all, Balzac, appreciating the beautiful, which will lead to a kind of life. And that probably in the classless society, you won't be able to appreciate Shakespeare and Balzac and diamonds and Mozart and Beethoven. Because labor would no longer be alienated. So it is a highly cultural utopia. It's a highly cultural utopia, and it's a highly bourgeois utopia. It is a kind of utopia as you sat around the Thanksgiving table in Cedar Rapids or in the suburb of Milwaukee or wherever you were that you could all agree upon if you really thought about it, yes? Provided you stayed in your big house and with your servants if you had some. And all of that sort of stuff, yes? But then Marx never had anything against that. He had a servant all his life, given to him by his mother, yes? Engels wrote a lovely essay about Marx's servant, who was even buried with the Marxists, you see, because the attitude toward servant was so different. Very difficult to make clear to the younger generation that up to my generation, if you had household servants, they were part of the family. They didn't think of themselves oppressed. For example, whatever my family saved from the Nazis was saved under the eyes of the Nazis by faithful servants. That was everybody's experience, yes? So Marx had one of these. I forget her name. She didn't think of herself as oppressed at all. So what you have therefore here is, of course, a kind of odd bourgeois utopia built into Marxism. Now, from this, I must go on to the difference between Marx and Engels, because the difference is very great. And the misunderstanding of Marxism is to treat Marx and Engels as twins, something I think that George Lichtheim and others have destroyed once and for all. Engels lived 12 years longer than Marx, which wouldn't be so important, except that he came under the influence of Darwin, an influence Marx, as you will see in a minute, rejected. But Engels took upon him wholeheartedly. Marx, in other words, for Marx, man has the ability to rearrange the world of which he was a part, but no longer for Engels. Because Engels had a faith in science. And Engels was taken by science. Here I remind you of that again. If I read to you the speech of Engels at Marx's tomb in Highgate Cemetery in London, Marx's funeral oration for Engels, which reads as follows. find it in a minute, which reads as follows. Just as Darwin discovered the law of development of organic nature, so Marx discovered the law of development of human history. This simple fact, hitherto concealed by an overgrowth of ideology, that mankind must first of all eat, drink, and have shelter and clothing before it can pursue science, art, and a religion. That the degree of economic development attained by a given epoch is the foundation upon which all else is built. Here you have what Marx never had, the foundation of an economic determinism, which goes together with this idea of science. But that is not all. Marx also discovered the special laws of motion governing present-day capitalist mode of production. In other words, the law of history are like the scientific laws of motion. They exclude men, if you like. They exclude men entirely. Marx, otherwise, is the new Darwin. The new Darwin. That is what Engels said over Marx's freshly dug tomb. And perhaps we can put it this way. That for Marx, cognition had a central role. That for Marx, consciousness had a central role, as I've made clear, together with the social scene, the way history works, that man is a creature of his consciousness as well as a social creature. But for Engels, this is really, in a sense, no longer the case. Engels rebukes Kant, for example. The world is not part of our creation. Matter has a capacity of giving birth to the mind. Material motion is invested with a logical certainty, an urge toward systematization. And here, as it were, what is important is Engels' chief theoretical work, which was written after Marx's death, his so-called Dialectic of Nature, his chief theoretical work. Now, in this Dialectic of Nature, the very first sentence tells you what it is all about. Modern research into nature alone has received systematic scientific development. And to Engels' desire that the history and activity of men become scientific, exclude what he calls the unintended effects and uncontrolled forces. This is really the idea. There must no longer be unintended effects and uncontrolled forces in the dialectic of nature. As he puts it as follows, very well. On the other hand, the more human beings become removed from animals, in the narrower sense of the word, the more they make their history themselves, consciously. That's fine, but listen to what follows. The less becomes the influence of unforeseen effects and uncontrolled forces on this history. The more accurately does the historical result correspond to the aim laid down in advance. If, however, we apply this measure to human history, we find that there exists a colossal disproportion between the aims and the results arrived at, that unforeseen effects predominate, that uncontrolled forces are more powerful than those according to Flan, and we must change that. The closer we come to the classless society, to the revolution of the proletariat, the more we fulfill the plan, the nearer we are to eliminating from history uncontrolled forces, the closer we are to a science. So history is a science. The more we understand the workings of history, that the bourgeois comes out of feudalism and the proletariat out of the bourgeois, the more we understand the dialectic, the more we exclude unforeseen forces, including any forces human nature itself might have, and the more we are a science. That is what he is saying. We leave the realm of animals, the more we become a scientific, and our actions determined to plans in advance. The more we can integrate our action with the scientific plan of the universe. Now, there is no longer here any role for cognition. There is no longer here, however delicately balanced, any role, if you want, for this kind of thing. But if you read Marx on Darwin, it becomes something quite different. This is what Marx has to say about that in his book, The Capital, in the Das Kapital. The weak points, he said, in the abstract materialism of natural science, a materialism that excludes history and its process, are evident. In other words, he would say about Engels' ideas that it includes history and its process. Because what you don't have here is history as process. History as process. Here, history is science. It's laid down in advance. But for Marx, there was always history as process. History which in the end leads to a utopia which cannot be forecast. In the end, human nature, happiness, rationality, and freedom will realize themselves in history. That is the Hegelian idea. It will realize itself in history. History is process. With Engels, history is no longer process. History is given. Is given. It is scientific. It is laid down in advance. And so you get the emphasis on the dictatorship of the proletariat. You get the emphasis that there can be no uncertainty, no storming of the Bastille, nothing, as it were, laid down in advance. Instead, you get something quite different. You get a determinism, which means everything has to be regulated, including the classless society, which with Marx's yet is, as it were, deregulated, the scientific spirit. Now it is clear that Engels is the father, in a sense, of Bolshevism, but also of social democracy, because this is the idea of his secretary. And Engels' secretary became what used to be called the Pope of German Socialism. The Pope of German Socialism, Karl Kautsky. And Karl Kautsky, who in a way became the ideologue of German social democracy until the First World War, and therefore for all of European socialism, really, Karl Kautsky had the same idea. Karl Kautsky, Marxism becomes economic determinism. For Karl Kautsky, revolution is beside the point, because as everything is laid down in advance according to scientific laws, the scientific law is that capitalism develops to its fullest extent. Then the dialectic is put into motion. And then the classless society comes about. So there is no need for revolution, no need to go on the barricades. History determines. So Kautsky founds what we call the gradualism of social democracy, Engels' secretary. But it is also the foundation, in a way, for Bolshevism, Because what Bolshevism does, it takes the dictatorship of the proletariat and projects it into something Marx never projected it into, as you will see, the classless society, so as to keep control, to keep control, and not only to keep control, but really to keep, as it were, to the plan. Now, with all of this said, I think, in all fairness, there is an entirely different side to Engels, a side that is quite different, but that did not have a very great impact. That is to say, after Marx's death, Engels writes about science. But when he writes about literature and art, it is something totally different. Here, some of it you will find in the culture of Western Europe, in the Marxist chapters. Here it broadens rather than narrows the framework of historical materialism. For example, in a letter of 1890, closely before his death, he makes the statement that economic factors only determine indirectly the changes and development of intellectual culture, of intellectual tradition. Here the world seems to him a many-sided thing. Here he emphasizes the superstructure, as he would say, rather than the control of the means of production. Now, why does he do that? You can't answer it except to say here his youth becomes determinate, his German youth, his love for German literature and German art. For the classics, Engels is self-educated. He admired even German myth, the Nibelungenlied. He wrote a poem exalting the German language over the French. All of this, and that meant in the end that Engels was confused about literature, as Marx was confused about literature, because somehow it was very difficult to love Shakespeare and Balzac and to believe in alienated labor, with one exception. And that really became dominant in all socialism. It happened that Shakespeare and Balzac wrote when the bourgeoisie was a revolutionary force. And so you could say, yes, there was great literature at the turn of the 18th and 19th century when the bourgeoisie was a progressive force. But there has been no great literature since then, and the new great literature will only come when the proletariat takes over. This was socialist dogma, and that will lead to something very important indeed, namely that socialists had no relationship to modern art. That explains to you why neither Bolshevism nor socialism had any relationship whatsoever to modern art, why all socialist congresses condemned modern art, even naturalism in the end. What socialists read, whether they are Lenin or Rosa Luxemburg or whoever, they didn't read Gerhard Hauptmann, they didn't read the Expressionists, they didn't read modern art. They read the classics, Goethe, Lessing, Balzac. Their literary reading was fossilized between the end of the 18th and the beginning of the 19th century, and that is still true. So that modern art and the avant-garde had to be excluded, according to this theory. And that explains to you the extreme philistinism of, let us say, the modern communist world. Yes? And their worship of tradition. We were visited here once by a high functionary from communist East Germany. And he came into my house and he brought me a present. And I thought, oh, how wonderful, a Meissen china. I collect porcelain. You know what he brought me? A plant from Goethe's garden. Now that is communism and worship of tradition. You see. But that is built in, you see, a dreadful plant. I promptly gave it to one of my colleagues in the German department. It annoyed him endlessly because they're, of course, all against this Goethe worship. But as this colleague happens to be quite friendly to the DDR, I thought he deserved this ugly plant. Anyway, what you have, therefore, here is clear. You have this thing, which is very difficult, perhaps, for you to grasp, too, a kind of conservatism of taste, which comes then from this theory that, oh, yes, Marx had loved Balzac and Lessing and Shakespeare, and Engels still did, but that you had to square it with the theory in that this is still great literature because then the bourgeoisie was a revolutionary class. And so you loved the German classics or the French classics, but nothing since the classics, nothing since these classics, yes? And therefore, you get the fact that neither socialism nor Bolshevism has any relationship to avant-garde art, none at all. And that it is, in fact, forbidden now in the communist world, of course, which seeks its legitimization through the classics. But even if you think of these great revolutionaries like Rosa Luxemburg, yeah, a great hero to an earlier generation of our students, you think of Rosa Luxemburg. She didn't like the expressionists. She didn't like modern art. She read Schiller and Goethe and Balzac, yes? Nothing since then. And not even naturalism. So you have this kind of cultural conservatism. But again, in Marx's time, it was not. Because Marx, of course, liked Balzac, was his contemporary, more or less, yes? So Marx didn't have it. Engels had it already, and you have it later, and it is a kind of feature, if you like, of a legitimization which you have there. Now to summarize what I wanted to make clear today. First of all, Marx then has a theory of human nature, which explains to you many of the difficulties of his theory, some of which I will come back to eventually. Second of all, this theory of human nature gets obliterated in the influence of Darwinism and Engels when Marxism becomes a science, which it was not. I just read you Marx's condemnation of abstract materialism. The laws of Darwin for Marx would have been as abstract as Feuerbach or Hegel. For Marx, it is an interplay. Marx was a Hegelian. It was an interplay. I can't stress that enough. For Engels, it becomes ever more abstract and scientific. Therefore, Engels talks about historical materialism. Marx never uses the phrase historical materialism. Engels does. Therefore, two things or three things drop out of Marx himself. First of all, the Hegelianism is in a way co-opted by Darwin. Engels was fascinated by science, by anthropology. Marx's proofs are from history and economics. Engels' proofs are from science or anthropology. It's very significant that most of Engels' proofs are from science and anthropology, and Marx's proofs from history and economics. That is very significant in this regard. So that you have this kind of obliteration of the human essence, this trend towards historical materialism. Thirdly, you have with Engels still a kind of contradiction between his literature and his economics, his literature, and his politics. With his secretary Kautsky, you have none. Then you already have it pretty clear this economic determinism, this schematization, this downplaying of cognition. You have it clear there, you see, but you don't have it before. Now, with all of this, I think I have covered for you two problems of Marxism. The problem of the human essence and the problem of Marx and Engels. From that, on Wednesday, I have to go on to a new problem in Marxism, the problem that you'll all love, the problem of the masses, the people, the thing many of your brothers and sisters loved so much. They wanted to reach out, yes? The thing that became so important in the socialist movement, that in all my youth, we wanted to go to the people. I never worked in a factory, but I did work for the Quakers very well. I worked very badly, but it was a good thing to do in the Depression. I walked among Welsh miners. I dug for them gardens. But if you know my green thumb is, I added to the starvation. I dug gardens, allotments we used to call them, for the Welsh miner in the Depression. And that was to me going to the people. And I remember how shocked I was when I found that they liked lace curtains and had all the bourgeois philistine attitudes, you see. Well, yes, obviously. But I was shocked that, because we had this idea about the people, the great people, you know, the people must triumph. You see. Well, I'll talk about Marx and the people next time. It's an important affair.